Gracias, muchas gracias.
That's the great Mercedes Sosa, the revered voice of the voiceless in the Spanish-speaking world with Solo Lo Pido a Dios, All I Ask of God. It's one of the great protest anthems of all time. Just to give you a sample, the lyrics say, All I ask of God is that I not be indifferent to suffering, or that I will not come to my point of death having failed to do what I could. All I ask of God is that I will not be indifferent to injustice, that I will not merely turn the other cheek after the first has been scratched or clawed. But that's the great Mercedes Sosa, known as La Negra, literally the black one, although she was, of course, of Quechua, Mestizo, and Amerindian ancestry. Born in Argentina, died 3 years ago at the age of 74, but world-renowned for her opposition to brutal dictatorships. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It's Friday the 9th, the end of an election week that, by any measure, was historic and precedent-setting. One of the precedents that was set was by the definitive emergence of Spanish-speaking voters as a victory-determining voting bloc. Our guest will help us understand the significance of this. Our guest is Professor Luis Escipio, who is a political scientist, professor of political science at the University of California, Irvine, where he teaches Chicano and Latino studies. He has written extensively on Latino politics and on governmental policies having inordinate impact on Latinos, and he joins us today, and we're delighted to have you back here. Thanks, Professor Escipio, for being with us today.
It's my pleasure.
Well, let's start where the most obvious point is, and that is the significance of this voting bloc that literally was a victory-determining voting bloc, along with the so-called minority voting blocs. Tell us about, in your view, the significance of the Latino vote in this election.
I think we're seeing the continuing growth of Latino voice and Latino power in American politics. 2012 continues the trend that we first saw in 2008, where minority electorates, Latinos, African Americans, Asian Americans, and to the extent that we know, Native Americans, though I'll be honest, there's not a lot of data on the Native American community, were the determining voice in American politics. White voters shunned candidate Obama in 2008 and President Obama in 2012, and it was strong support from minority communities And particularly in this one, Asian Americans, which I think is a community that we need to talk a little bit about, that ensured an Obama re-election nationally, but also ensured his Electoral College victories in Florida, which I realize is still outstanding, but it looks like it's going into the president's camp, in Nevada, in Colorado, in Virginia, states where a minority voice has not traditionally been heard.
I want to just go back a little bit to your introduction. When you say was shunned, how did you come to that conclusion?
Well, they moved away from the president relative to their support for John McCain in 2008. And in this race, we don't have absolutely definitive data. We're relying on exit polls now, which are not the most reliable source. But it would appear that less than 40% of the white vote went to the president. And one of the big questions that the media was asking over the last several weeks is, can anybody win the presidency with less than 40% of the white vote? And I think what we learned in 2012 is that the answer is yes, and that will be more true in the future. More importantly, I think we learned that we can have a non-disputed election with a candidate winning less than 40% of the white vote. Now, I'm certainly not saying the Democrats in the future shouldn't reach out to whites and shouldn't identify some, common economic issues that are shared by minority communities and white voters. But I think we've shown in this race, as we did in 2008, that a candidate with an effective message and an effective outreach strategy to minority communities can overcome a lack of support in the white community.
Well, you've been tracking elections since 1988. What is different, would you say, about 2012's election cycle?
Well, I think a couple of things are worth noting. One is that, whatever we, say about different segments of the electorate, and we can certainly talk about, other divisions, age particularly, the Obama campaign ran a very effective ground war. Ground war is a long-term strategy to ensure that you mobilize, you prepare people to vote for you, and then you get them out to vote, on election day or in the weeks before in states that allow early voting. Democrats have traditionally not followed the strategy, I think to their detriment. And President Obama, or candidate Obama, beginning in 2008, showed that the investment in that it's a technology investment, it's a human investment, it's a candidate investment in terms of his time to ensure that people that are likely to vote for you are registered to vote, know where to vote, know how to vote, and then are reminded to vote over and over and over again, that sort of strategy can turn out lower propensity voters. And unfortunately, Democratic voters tend to be a little bit more less likely to vote, holding everything equal than Republican voters. So candidate Obama in 2008 and then President Obama in 2012 showed that investment can really work and turn lots of people out that you don't necessarily expect to turn out otherwise. And, we've heard the stories of 3 and 4 hour long lines in many of the battleground states because people were committed to voting by election day. They weren't a month before, but the ground war ensured that they were. So one important story about 2012 is sort of the effectiveness of, these outreach and mobilization strategies, in a time when an incumbent president would otherwise have problems, and certainly the unemployment rate didn't bode well for President Obama's reelection. I think a second story that needs to be told is the emergence of a relatively cohesive minority vote, both in 2008, but even more so in 2012. We've often used that term, a minority vote, because we see that all, the three largest minority communities, African Americans, Latinos, and Asian Americans, tend to vote for the Democrats at higher rates than do non-Hispanic whites. But what became true in 2012 is that they didn't just vote for the Democrats at a higher rate, they voted for the Democrats at a dramatically higher rate. So you have over 70% of both Latinos and Asian Americans voting for the Democrats and the expected over 90% of African Americans voting for the Democrats. So the minority vote cohered in a way that it probably hasn't in the past, and that ensured the president's victory in several of the close battleground states. So I think that's a second story that needs to be told. There's now this this block of voters that is not three blocks, but closer to a single one, and a group that responds an electorate that responds to some of the same kinds of issues. I think the third story that needs... I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
The third story that needs to be told in 2012, and this is the one that we're seeing a little bit in the media right now, is that the Republicans are responsible for some of their own loss in that they did such a poor job of reaching out to minority communities, and even worse, did an excellent job of alienating minority communities. Governor Romney, I think, never overcame his advocacy of self-deportation, and that pushed a higher share of Latinos and Asian Americans into the Democratic camp. His sort of tone deafness about the growing diversity of the United States was a failure that he was never able to overcome and never really understood, I don't think. And leaders of the Republican Party, not necessarily the grassroots, but the leaders see the writing on the wall and recognize that they need a more effective strategy, not to win the minority vote. They don't expect that, but at least to hold on to a higher share than they got in this election. And they're going to be struggling for the next 2 to 4 years to sort of identify, how to frame an argument to, particularly to Latinos and Asian Americans, I think, to win some of them back.
In your memory of analyzing these elections since 1988, do you recall a temperature, a racial temperature, as pronounced as the one in 2012?
No. Certainly at the state level, there have been years or election cycles that were that reflected more antipathy between minorities and the majority community. Certainly California around Proposition 187, Arizona in a couple of recent election cycles over immigration issues. But this 2012 nationalized the distance between minority communities and non-Hispanic whites in a way that we really haven't seen before. And I would put the blame for that in a bad economy. Certainly in bad periods of bad economy, there are always more likely to be invidious distinctions between groups. But I think the Republican primary sort of brought that to a boiling point with each candidate, with the exception, interestingly, of Governor Rick Perry, who flamed out on other grounds. So all of the candidates seeing who could be the most restrictionist in his or her rhetoric.
But is it possible that both the president and the constituents that, as you put it, cohered in order to deliver political victory for him at the polls were reading the same thing? They were reacting to the same thing. I mean, I have never heard in my time of reporting on elections, national elections, local elections, I have never seen or heard such disrespect, not only for the office, but particularly for the person occupying the office, on I would call it just blatantly racist grounds. I've never seen the office of the presidency or the president treated in such an across-the-board disrespectful way. So maybe it is the case that along with other factors, prepared the Obama campaign to do a more intense job of organizing within the constituencies where they believed they had a simpatico. They were able to get the understanding because they were both basically subjected to the same thing. People witnessed the same thing. What do you think about that?
I think that is a good analysis, but I would credit also the Obama administration with giving minority communities a positive reason to support the president's reelection and not just a reaction against the Republicans.
Well, no, certainly not just a reaction, but I agree with that as well. Yes.
Yeah, no, I think, presidents are elected through a combination of fear and hope. And certainly 2008 might have weighted that a little bit more towards the hope end. But in most elections, fear of the opponent or of you know, the other party is part of the story. I think the Obama campaign through maybe the beginning of the election cycle, you know, into January or February of this year, relied mostly on hope. Mostly on fear. But over the course of 2012, through a series of both policy changes and then improved messaging, they gave minority communities, particularly young minority voters who were the most sort of optimistic, and that's positive for the nation, a positive reason to support President Obama. So in terms of Latino and Asian American communities, deferred action, a strategy within the limits of the president's regulatory authorities to at least delay deportation and provide temporary work authorization for young unauthorized immigrants. In terms of the economy, targeting a message about economic growth, particularly in the private sector, and reduced loan costs for students in college. Speaking of the advantages of the Affordable Care Act, you know, all of these certainly were messages that spoke to the nation as a whole, but they had particular resonance in minority communities because it is young adults who will benefit the most from each of these, and minority communities tend, on average, to be younger than non-Hispanic white communities. So certainly the president's campaign team was not above creating the cultural connection between the way Obama has been treated over the last 4 years and the way minority communities are generally treated in the United States. But he also didn't want to just rely on fear, and I think he created hope as well.
Almost 20 years ago, you wrote, "Counting on the Latino vote, Latinos as a new electorate." And yet, recently, you talked about Latino electorates, plural. In light of their performance in this election, would you say that there is now a singular electorate, a Latino electorate, or are there still Latino electorates, plural?
We're closer to having a single electorate, but there remain, as there are in any community, some divisions. The Cuban American community in South Florida remains more Republican than Democrat. I mean, it's a little bit tactical in its vote, so it will certainly support Democrats statewide in Florida when it's in the interest of the Cuban American community. And I think the Republicans have been very skilled over the last few years in identifying some Latino leaders who can speak as Republicans, and here Marco Rubio comes to mind, who's already on everybody's short list for a 2016 presidential candidacy. Susana Martinez, another example, the governor of New Mexico, who is a Republican and is genuinely a Republican. I mean, he's not just a Republican of convenience. So the Latino electorate has become more Democratic, certainly in the period since I've written in the book, and even more so in the Obama years. Those partisan loyalties, I don't think, are cemented if the Republicans find a way to sort of break their own logjam and begin to speak to some of the issues that Latino communities care about. Asian American electorates, I think, would be another example where, there have traditionally been some differences based on national origin in Asian American voting. Those diminished considerably in 2012. Asian Americans became more Democratic than they ever have been in the past, but some of the Asian American national origin groups, particularly the immigrants in those communities, maintain Republican loyalty here, I think, particularly Vietnamese Americans.
You also said that sheer numbers alone do not ensure that Latino communities will become central to the American political process. To what degree do you have to revise that statement?
I would put that in partisan terms now. Had the election gone slightly differently, had Governor Romney been able to hold on in Ohio and one or two of the other battleground states and won a very narrow victory in the Electoral College, the Latino electorate and the minority electorate, for that matter, would have been largely irrelevant. Latinos are important when Democrats win at this point. I think for Republicans to win, Republicans aren't going to win the majority of Latinos by any means, but what they can do is discourage Latino turnout. Not that they can suppress it through legal means, and there will certainly be some of that, but they can also present a Democratic candidate as being out of touch, and, you know, Latinos will stay at home. And here I'd use the example of John Kerry, the Democrats' 2004 nominee, who did a terrible job of reaching out to Latino electorates as part of his campaign. George Bush didn't do a great job, but at least he tried. And the effect was that growth rate of Latino voting declined a little bit, and in several key states, Latinos, you know, gave more of their votes to the Republicans, not necessarily a majority, but enough that Kerry didn't win. And, you know, they were important in a negative sense, but they weren't getting the candidate of their choice out of that. So Latinos are critical now to Democratic victories for the foreseeable future at the national level and in many of the states. They're not yet critical in years of Republican dominance. And 2010, you know, the most recent off-year congressional election would be an example of that, where Latinos tended to stay home. I mean, you know, at higher rates, off-year elections don't generate the same sort of buzz. And the consequence was the election of, you know, a large number of very conservative Republicans to Congress, including some from areas where Latinos are dominant.
Is this, based on the results and the interpretation of the results, is this a fertile soil to again explore the possibility of real coalition politics, or is that just a pipe dream? With these groups also, although they flex their muscle, they flex their muscles independently of each other, is that going to dominate, or is there going to be any movement toward coalition building on the basis of racial identity?
My sense is that the most fertile ground for that sort of coalitional politics will be at the state and particularly at the local level. At the national level, you know, minority communities, with some exceptions in a handful of cities, don't tend to live around each other. So, for example, you know, Virginia, which was one of the battleground states, the concentrations of Latino voters were, you know, in the Washington suburbs. The concentrations of African American voters were in Richmond and then down into the Tidewater. They came together with a shared interest, but they didn't necessarily have a strong incentive to work together to achieve that end. However, in municipal politics, you know, I think we've already seen some, you know, some good interracial, multiracial coalitions that have, you know, sort of overcome white dominance to elect a minority office holder and maybe even a succession of minority office holders. And I think we're going to begin to see that at the state level in some of the states that have multiple racial and ethnic populations, certainly here in California, in Texas, in Florida. So, you know, the national campaigns tend to be run not from the grassroots, but instead from the top down. And what we learned in 2012 is if they're successful, they mobilize the grassroots. But it's not, you know, the foundation of a coalition is really not going to be, you know, dropped in from a campaign headquarters in Chicago or a campaign headquarters in Boston.
Well, what happens now? Having demonstrated their power as a group, African Americans, Latinos, Asians, what is now, with specifically as a response to the appeal of the Obama camp as opposed to the Romney camp? They preferred Obama over Romney for a number of reasons, and they demonstrated their loyalties in terms of their vote. What happens now? Because this was a point of friction with candidate Obama. And, you know, of course, during his administration as president, the sense that there was some degree of insularity with the Obama administration once victory was achieved, that there was a sense of distance. Especially, I'm talking now about the African-American community, there was a sense of distance, that he was not responding to high-priority items on the African-American agenda. Do you think that the Obama administration would be more amenable now, or in what ways would these disparate groups, having demonstrated their power, could now collateralize that with demands on the administration?
Yeah. Well, I would see one sort of short-term answer and then one medium-term answer. The short-term answer, and I realize that this will not speak to the core needs of the African-American community, is comprehensive immigration reform. The president tried a couple of times, some would say half-heartedly, during the first administration to build a coalition around, a reform to our immigration system. And then he used the regulatory powers of the presidency to achieve some ends. I think now he's committed to make, a full-bore effort, an effort comparable to what he did with Affordable Care, to force pressure a compromise around immigration. And a compromise, by definition, is not going to satisfy everybody. It's probably going to include some things that I, as a scholar of immigration, think are pretty repugnant, but I also understand what a compromise is, that you give and in exchange for other things that you want. I would be very surprised if the administration doesn't move forward with a serious proposal, maybe coming out of Senator Schumer, so coming out of the Senate. And I also sort of suspect that at least the Republican leadership will engage in that discussion because they don't want to permanently lose the Latino vote and the Asian American vote. So that's sort of a short-term answer to your question. I think in the medium term, what each of the minority communities needs to do is press the Obama administration and the Democratic National Committee to support some prominent minority candidacies, and here particularly African-American candidacies, in the midterm elections. The field, if you will, of Senate candidates in 2012 and gubernatorial candidates was remarkably white for an increasingly diverse America. And I think that might have been, obviously candidates are chosen by primary, so it's not purely in the control of the national committees, but they have some voice there. I think 2014 has to reverse that trend so that there is a next generation of African American Democrats, Latino Democrats, Asian American Democrats at the statewide level, either governorships or senators. And that's a very tangible sort of demand that can be made, sort of behind the scenes. It's not one that you do publicly, but it ensures that the topics of race and diversity and inclusion are before the American people in 2014. That's also critically important for the Democrats because they need to do a better job of turnout in midterm elections than they did in 2010. It's always difficult in the sixth year of a president's term for the incumbent party to hold on to what it already has. So mobilizing some key electorates is in their interest, and having some good minority candidates would achieve that. I guess the third piece of it is, sort of how the minority communities interact with the White House around, the issues of entitlement reform and deficit reduction. It's going to be on the table. Though deficit reduction does not necessarily speak to the interests of minority communities who generally need a more activist interventionist government, and that costs more money. But I think, President Obama is going to be engaged in those conversations. So who are the minority voices that he's listening to ensure that the disproportionate effect of those is not felt among the poorest and least advantaged in the United States? That's an open question right now.
Well, I want to get to what to me is a glaring omission here, and that is the utter failure of the third parties to attract a more diverse response. They have not moved beyond 1% of the vote. And what is your assessment of the impact of third parties in this election, as opposed to any other election, at the time when you would think that third parties would provide a logical alternative to mainstream party politics? You have a constituency, or you have several constituencies that are primed and ready to listen to what you have to say. Why haven't third parties moved beyond this 1%.
Well, I think, you know, the system is certainly rigged towards the advantage of the two major parties. You know, it's very hard for a third party, even one that, you know, has independent means like the Libertarians, to run in more than a handful of districts. And we have over 600,000 elective offices in the United States. So, you know, if you run for 6,000 of those, you know, you're still only running in one of 100, and it's very rare that any third party does. I think the second sort of dynamic of third parties in the United States is that they're never class-based. Well, I guess the Libertarians are class-based, but at the other end. I mean, the third parties tend to speak to a very narrow constituency, often of either the advantaged or the middle class, and they've never really invested in the kind of ground war that Obama did so successfully in 2008 and 2012. I think you'd need that sort of ground war to get your word out to minority communities in any large number. And that costs a lot of money, and it also requires a dedication and a long-term investment. I don't think you can do it in a single election cycle. So my suspicion is that minority communities will be ill-served by parties other than the dominant ones for the foreseeable future, just because the third parties aren't long-term endeavors that do a lot in between elections, and that's what you need to do to mobilize new electorates.
We're talking with Professor Louis DeCipio, political scientist at the University of California, Irvine. Your calls at 1-888-874-4888. 1-888-874-4888. We return to Professor DeCipio right after this break. The great Mercedes Sosa of Argentina with Todo Lo Pido a Dios, All I Ask of God, the great, great anthem of protest. And, of course, at her passing 3 years ago, the entire world, actually, even in the English-speaking or non-Spanish-speaking world, was at a loss. Anyway, we here at PRN.FM. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and our guest is Professor Louis DeCipio, political scientist at the University of California, Irvine, and we're talking about the Latino vote as it was evidenced in the recently concluded elections. We have Christine from Queens. Christine, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'd like to, actually I had a couple of comments, but I'm going to stick with the first one, maybe if I have time at the end of this comment. I'd like to go back and refer to Howard Dean, because of what the professor was saying regarding third parties in America and why, and I think you posed a question as to why they really, you know, haven't been a little more decisive. I remember that when he was running in the primaries, if you recall that particular fall, he was, if I remember correctly, on the front page of Time magazine. And he was really high in the polls at the time. There was a possibility that he might have been the Democratic candidate. And the Democratic Party, of which I was one, I still have their card. I don't really sympathize with them anymore for obvious reasons, but I remember at the time that he was buckled at the knees by his own Democratic Party, in spite of the fact that he later became the Democratic National Committee chairman, and he brought in a lot of votes, at least by you know, having served the party very well. I think that he was very, to this day, it amazes me that he's never referred to. And this was my point. He was doing very well. This was not a marginal candidate. Now, regardless of how one felt about him, I felt, and a lot of, most of the people that I knew, seriously, even more conservative ones, liked Howard Dean very much. They found him to be a real American, to use that in quotes. He had done, you know, very well in Vermont, and he was buckled at the knees. And I remember when he said, when he was speaking, I would watch C-SPAN very often at the time, and he was speaking at a university, I believe, when he was doing, you know, when he was going around speaking at different colleges and universities and speaking to the people. I believe he was, I'm not sure if he was in New Hampshire, it doesn't really matter. But I remember him saying one thing. After he decided to suspend his campaign, and he said that Americans are conservative with a small c. I remember this one sentence because it stayed with me, and I believe that it, I've very often thought of that leading up to this election as well, because in spite of what Americans, and I'm including all Americans in this country, including African Americans who have been here longer than many European immigrants who came in the last century, that I think that we have a belief of ourselves as being very open-minded and progressive, and that is true to a large degree. But when it comes to stepping outside of that political thinking box, I don't know how else to put it, I think that we that the country is not as open, and I don't know what the word is, rather illiberal at this point. I don't like these labels because I don't find them to be very, they just don't serve us anymore. But I don't think that we have this thing that we believe about ourselves when it was the Wild West and people took just these wild chances and we were pioneers. I don't think that we have a pioneering spirit to the degree that we think we do anymore. And I wanted to pay homage to Howard Dean again because I don't think that he's referred to enough. I don't think that he's even spoken about. The man, you know, he came out, he was, okay, later on he might have conceded because maybe he wanted to work within the party to have a voice. But I think the Democratic Party totally obliterated him. I don't think he deserved that kind of treatment. And it started to occur to me after that, it occurred to me how rigged the system was. And it wasn't only because I, you know, I wanted him to become the candidate. It was also because of the way the caucuses were run and how a lot of these caucuses basically were not one person, one vote. I mean, you have a couple of the states who determine who the candidate is going to be. And really, when you think about it, why do we bother to vote the rest of the country if we're told that Iowa and Ohio are determinants of who's going to be the candidate? You know what I mean? And so I just wanted to throw that in there because a lot of this post-election analysis, and it happened the last election, is just, you know, I don't mean to be condescending to people who do this work and journalists. I mean, if I were one, I guess I would be in the same position. But it's kind of like a lot of blather to me at this point. I just feel that we need to look at something honestly and take positions and say, you know, this is the way it is, and we need to take chances in our lives. I don't know.
All right. Well, let's have Professor DeCipio react to your comment. Thank you so much for it.
Well, there was certainly a lot in that question, and I think I can respond to parts of it. I don't know that I have a comprehensive answer. You know, certainly Governor Dean did some very creative minority outreach. I had friends, Latino friends in Iowa, which was the first caucus, that complained that they got onto almost a first-name basis with the staff from the Dean campaign that were calling and trying to mobilize them because they called so frequently. But the larger concern about the primaries and caucuses is, I think, one that the nation will have to come to terms with over the next few years, because those early primaries and caucuses are in states that don't have very large minority communities. In fact, they have trivial minority communities. So to the extent that we continue to give Iowa and New Hampshire a disproportionate voice in the selection of the president, we're going to weight the process towards white candidates. That said, I'd say the Republicans paid a price for that this year. If they had had some of their initial primaries and caucuses in more diverse states, they might have selected, they might have toned down their rhetoric a bit, which would have been in their interest in the long run. The Electoral College, which I think the caller also raised, you know, the dilemma of focusing on Ohio and Virginia and, Iowa and those states, I think is a huge problem in terms of the minority electorate. Looking at 2008 data, I don't have the 2012 yet, about 21% of white voters lived in one of the battleground states. For African-American voters, it was about 17%, for Latinos, 13%, and for Asian-Americans, 11%. What does that mean? Well, if you're a white voter, you're twice as likely to have your vote, the candidates and the candidate campaigns care about your vote than if you're an Asian-American voter. That's wrong in a democracy. The Electoral College was designed to impede the popular will, and it continues to. The dilemma is now that it impedes the minority will more than it impedes the majority will. So, you know, these things need to be changed. Of course, they require supermajorities to change them.
Well, I want to just latch on to that word there that has popped up so often, the word minority. The demographics are suggesting that by 2025, the United States would not be a majority white population. So what do you see as the political response by the established political organizations, the established political parties, and the established political rule, political authorities? And on the flip side of that, the insurgent groups, how should they now be preparing for 2025 when the demographic shift occurs?
The electorate will be slower to shift than the population as a whole. The minority communities are younger on average than non-Hispanic white communities. Consequently, they age into both, eligibility at age 18, but also likely voting later than that. Similarly, Asian American and Latino communities have higher share of immigrants who are not eligible to vote. So the electorate will probably be majority white into the 2050s. There are two paths. One is one that was followed by European ethnics in the late 19th and early 20th century, and that was that they progressively came to be understood as and understood themselves as white. That was contested for many years. Certainly Al Smith paid a price for that in 1928, but I think by the 1950s and 60s that was no longer contested. So some see a non-racialized path, particularly for Asian Americans and Latinos. I'm dubious of that myself. But I think that with intermarriage, there will be more second, third, and fourth generation Latinos and Asian Americans, or people who could self-identify as Latino and Asian American, that will have sort of ethnically migrated out. That will be a long-term process. I think in the shorter term, it gets back to your question about coalitions. It's the political power of minority communities is louder and stronger to the extent that they work together around issues of shared concern, and there are plenty of those. So to the degree, until pure numerical power can influence outcomes, power will be achieved by working together within minority communities and then making alliances with non-Hispanic whites who share a political agenda, share an ideological agenda.
One last question on this particular point, and that is, if on the basis of your oppression or exclusion or discrimination, you organize politically, that is to say, African Americans would organize on the shared history of oppression, Latinos similarly with exclusion, social exclusion, and so forth, are race-based political responses viable anymore?
Probably less than they have, at the national level, less than they have been in the past. The most successful organization has been around issues, not around shared status. And that's, I think, why class movements in the United States have been relatively unsuccessful. I think at the municipal level and in other local races, that sort of linked fate of shared exclusion can be a message that can be very effective at bringing new people into the process and getting people elected who wouldn't otherwise get elected. I think what the Obama campaigns over the last two cycles have shown is that, mobilizing minority communities is critical for Democrats to get elected, but they also need to have a message that links those communities, because those communities don't necessarily understand what they share in common at the grassroots, but also to create alliances with the labor movement, to create alliances with young adults, students, you know, that who might not themselves be racial or ethnic minorities.
But in a way, doesn't this election prove the viability of that point? Because you could argue that Romney's campaign was completely race-based in favor of whites. And that has not been an exception. I mean, in terms of politics in the United States, whether Republican or conservative, libertarian or Democratic parties, the assumption is that the first thing that people under these various banners have in common is their race, and white being the going requirement.
And he showed the limits of that sort of strategy in that despite a terrible economy and a president who had been demonized for 4 years, he was only able to get 48% of the vote. Now, you might say 48% is a lot, but it wasn't enough.
But assuming that Romney was a very charismatic guy and that he had, he had greater appeal than he turned out to have, assuming that he was an ideal candidate for the Republican Party, assuming that, wouldn't it have been the case just the same that such a candidate wasn't just appealing to class, but also to race? Because, they did not attract, it's amazing, profoundly white party. White party.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's paying the price for that. Ideal candidate is sort of a hard image to come up with, because an ideal candidate also wouldn't have spoken of self-deportation. An ideal candidate would have known how to muzzle himself, even if he believed that that was an appropriate public policy. So certainly, you know, if we can come up with an ideal candidate who also had the gift of Bill Clinton for turning a phrase, then perhaps that candidate would have done much better than Governor Romney did in 2012. What's interesting is he might not have done any better in some of the key battleground states, because there the Obama campaign was winning not because people loved Obama, but because they liked his policies, you know, particularly the auto bailout in the case of Ohio, which proved to be so important. So, you know, my reading of 2012 is that the Republicans were certainly running a racially exclusionary campaign, but the lesson was that alone isn't good enough anymore.
Well, thank you, Louis DeCipio, for joining us today. This was an extraordinarily informative session with you. Thanks so much.
And my pleasure.
And come back and talk some more politics sometime soon.
Absolutely. Look forward
to
it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much. And we've come to the end of our program almost. I want to thank you for your questions, Christine from Queens. Tomorrow is Saturday. On Monday, when we return, we'll continue this discussion, because there's a lot about this election that needs to be understood and analyzed and laid bare so that we can examine the entrails. That's the advantage of doing postmortems. You get to analyze the entrails without any objection. You can do that. So I want to thank you so much. I want also to encourage you send me little notes and send me some ideas that you have. That's great if you can do that at leadstories@gmail.com. I'm pretty swift in responding to your letters and comments. So drop me a line. Let me know what you're thinking. But I want you also to do some work, and some political work, and that is to connect with people that you know and let them know about PRN, and certainly about Lead Stories here on PRN at 1 p.m. Monday through Friday. Stay tuned for Richard Martin. He comes up next with Wake Up Call. Until then, have a good weekend, take care of yourselves, and let's meet here again on Monday. Thank you for the pleasure and privilege of your company. Bye-bye.